Thank you. One brief announcement first before I get started. The fall meeting, regional meeting of Philly Sauk, is going to be in September or October. I've been asked to be program chairman. The subject is going to be Mel Bradford, essentially, or a tribute to Mel Bradford. I know some of you will have ideas on that subject, and if you do, I wish you would communicate them to me. Right? I'm going to try to do here in maybe 12 minutes, 14 minutes tops, something that if I were in class would take me at least 3 one-hour lectures. I'm going to try to cover the things that 18th century Americans, Americans of the founding generation, had in common with one another, and the things they had which divided them and separated them, made them a distinct people, but also made them distinct peoples, plural. First, the things they had in common. Most of these derived from the fact of the English heritage. Among the attributes were the concept of limited government. Now, under English law and under English constitutionalism, all rights emanated from the crown, because the crown was reckoned as the vicar of God on earth. So rights come from God to the king to the subject. Nonetheless, government was limited because of the principle in Magna Carta that the king giveth, but he can't take back. People cannot be deprived, subjects cannot be deprived of their life, their liberty, or their property, except by the law of the land and by due process of law. Secondly, they had in common a tradition of government of laws, which made them very, very distinct from continental Europeans. As a part of the constitutional heritage and as a part of the legal heritage, they also had a tradition of active citizen participation in government, most notably through two institutions. One was the jury, in which all people, all adult males anyway, had to participate, and the other was the militia. On a day-to-day basis, this was government in America, and everybody had a part in it. Thirdly, the Americans had in common their religion. Now, there were maybe 15,000 Jews in America, there were maybe 60,000 Catholics in America. All the rest of the population was overwhelmingly Protestant. Of the Protestants, there were a handful of Dutch Reformed, there were a handful of Lutherans, but otherwise they were English Protestant. There were Methodists, there were Anglicans or Episcopalians, they were Baptists, they were Congregationalists, and so on. Right? Given the fact that they had a common Protestant tradition, certain other things followed. One was that the tradition of individual responsibility for the salvation of your soul, but also individual responsibility for your conduct on earth. But it was an individual responsibility which was enforced through communal mechanisms, through the congregation, through the jury, through various other independent community institutions. And another thing that came from their Protestantism, essentially came from their Protestantism, was literacy, right? If you're going to protesta, if you're going to testify, you've got to be able to read the Bible for yourself. And the Americans were overwhelmingly a literate people, which had a lot of implications. They read first and foremost, of course, the Bible. But they also, if you learned to read English, right, read and write in English, you also were overwhelmingly likely to have been taught Latin, which brought you into the realm of all kinds of ancient literature. And in addition to that, or as a byproduct of that, Americans had a very strong sense of history, of their place in history, of the continuity of history, of their connections with the ancient world, of their connections with the biblical world, of their connections with the long struggle for liberty in England. All this was a living part of the American character, the American psyche. So much in common. All of these things made some things possible. But there was also diversity, a good deal of diversity, and a good deal of divisiveness. It might seem on the face of it that couldn't be the case, because of the population, in the first census of 1790, the population was something over 3.9 million, right? Of whom 697,000 were slaves. of the remainder, the 3.2 million free whites, overwhelmingly they come from the British Isles. Right? There were Germans, there were Dutch, there were Swedes and Finns and an assortment of other people, a few French and a few French Huguenots, but overwhelmingly they originated in the British Isles. But you have to remember that historically Britain was not one thing, right? Or the British archipelago was not one thing. If you visualize a map of the island of Britain with Wales and the nose sticking out over on the left-hand side, there's a kind of a line that runs from the southwest corner up to the northeast corner. To the south and east of that line, the country for the most part is rolling, flat, open, right, and highly arable. The country to the north and west of that line, roughly, is hill country, very sometimes going into steep mountains. And there were two distinct sets of cultures, or rather, it's kind of a cultural fault line as well as anything else. South and west of the line, Englishmen were engaged in mixed agriculture, which means a combination of plow tillage agriculture and animal culture, and they were a commercial people. Lots of avenues of communication and rivers and such stuff as that. North and west of the line, they were overwhelmingly herding peoples, right? Even in the English portion of it, but the English portion of it is not the whole thing, because you've got down into Beard in the corner, the southwest corner is Cornwall, and the great Shakespearean scholar A.L. Rowse, who grew up in Cornwall, once said that when he was a kid, if you went to London, what you said was, I'm going off to England, right? I mean, the Cornish were a different people and understood themselves as such. The Welsh were a different people and understood themselves as such. And then you've got a whole mess of different kinds of Scotchmen. You've got Lowlanders, and you've got Highlanders, and you've got an entirely distinct culture, which is in the southwest of Ireland, of Scotland, the Western Highlands, the Hebrides, and north of Ireland, which were, until the end of the 14th century, were a separate kingdom, right? And these are culturally distinct people, too. And then you've got the pure Irish, or mere Irish, as they were sometimes called. All right. By virtue of historical accident, the people who came to the different parts of America at different times were recruited selectively on both sides of this line. New England was the most nearly homogeneous part of America. New England, interestingly enough, was settled overwhelmingly by a wave of emigration from 1629 to 1642, at the time when Charles I was trying to impose religious conformity and absolutism on England. 1642, when the troubles start and the civil wars begin and so on, they stop coming. They overwhelmingly, these Puritans who went to 1629, 1642, came from the southeastern half of Britain. Right? By 1790, the time of the first census, the population of New England was something in the order of 75 to 90% pure English, descended from those original settlers. There was no more immigration. One effort at immigration in 1718, a boatload of Scotch-Irish landed or tried to land in Boston, and they were met with signs, you know, no Irish need apply. A few Scotch-Irish did settle in the interior of New England, particularly the upper parts of it, but they were the exceptions. Okay. They're homogeneous, they're overwhelmingly English, they're overwhelmingly southeastern English, they're overwhelmingly Calvinist Congregationalist, with a very strong streak of Gnosticism in their character, right? They knew the truth, with a capital T. Moving down to the next section of the country, the middle states, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware, this was the most polyglot part of America. No single ethnic group, no single racial group, no single religious group constituted more than 35 or 40% of the population. There were an awful lot of Welshmen there. The original Quakers were, a lot of the original Quakers were Welsh, but they're the Dutch. There are all kinds of different groups, the Pennsylvania Dutch, the Germans, and after 1715, enormous numbers of Scotch-Irish immigrants. Okay. The third section is the Upper South, the tobacco-growing South, which is to say Maryland and Virginia and portions of North Carolina. These areas, the Chesapeake Bay area really, first was settled in the 17th century when the New England immigration stopped, the immigration to Chesapeake Bay began, right? And it goes during the period of the Civil Wars and during the period of the Commonwealth on a big scale. overwhelmingly, these people came from the northwest portion of the thing. There are very careful studies of who came during this period to Virginia and to Maryland, and they're overwhelmingly in the northwestern half of Britain. In the 18th century, there were two big waves of immigration into this region. One was Germans who landed in Philadelphia, moved to the interior, went down the valleys, settled the lowland valleys. The Germans behaved themselves, they were orderly, they stayed the heck out of politics, and were regarded as wonderful citizens. The Scotch-Irish, who began to come in 1715, were the opposite. They were clannish, as opposed to New England, with the idea of the nuclear family, they had extended families. They were herdsmen, they were drunks, they were lazy, they were disorderly, they fought like crazy, and they were into politics. They were very disruptively into politics. I can talk about them this way because I'm descended from them. But James Logan, the provincial secretary of Pennsylvania, who was himself a Scotch-Irishman, wrote in 1728, that early, that don't send us any more Scotch-Irish. Pennsylvania was looking for settlers because that's how the Penn proprietorship was a profitable enterprise, but no more Scotch-Irish, but they continued to come. Some of them landed in the lower South, in South Carolina, and particularly in Charleston, and moved to the interior, but most of them followed the same path from northeast to southwest that the German settlers did, except that they settled the uplands, continued to be herding people, herdsmen, and continued to be disruptive. Okay, the lower South was settled mainly, the original settlers of Charleston came mainly, of all places, from Ireland, by way of Barbados, right? So the very strong, pure Irish component in the population from the very beginning. And as time went by and the Scotch-Irish came, well, Ken Cribb will tell you what a wonderfully turbulent place South Carolina was at all times. Let me get to the bottom line because I just about used up my time. As a consequence of the patterns of immigration and as a consequence of the patterns of social evolution in America, there were at the time of the founding, on the one hand, the seeds of continental union, the seeds of liberty, and the seeds of an American national character. But there were simultaneously also the seeds of disunion and the seeds of sectional as opposed to national character, and ultimately the seeds of civil war. Thank you.
On May 16th, there's going to be an interview with Forrest on the Lamb C-SPAN book program, and I encourage you all to check your local listings and have the opportunity to. Is it 15th of May? So check your local listings, and I think you'll enjoy watching that particular program.